listening to the English Express Radio Podcast. Share the show with your friends by having them visit us online at theenglishexpress.com. You can also find us on Facebook or join our group on vk.com. All aboard the English Express.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the English Express Radio Podcast. Brandon is not here today because he's kind of a loser and he's hanging out with his stupid friends instead of being here. But I do have my buddy Sean with me. We did a bonus segment a couple of weeks ago with Sean here, and I thought it went pretty well. So I thought we'd come on and talk some political stuff. How you doing, Sean?
Good, Cliff. How's it going? How's it going there in Colorado?
Pretty good. You seem super excited to be here.
No, I'm literally reading as we speak because, as you know, one of the hot topics of the week is this whole delegate thing in Colorado, and I still don't quite understand what everyone's up in arms about. So,
Look, for most of the people who don't know, and I don't know how you don't. Unless you're living under a rock and literally do not pay attention to the news, but it's kind of a primary season here in America. We have basically a process where we elect the person who's going to be elected for president. Because how do you decide who's going to run for which party? Okay. And so they have each state kind of cast their votes for all of the possible candidates. Well, at least that's the way I thought it worked, that you casted your vote for the candidate that you liked, and whoever gets the most delegates or percentage of that state, they would run for the presidency. But here in Colorado, apparently your delegates can go to a particular candidate with absolutely no votes at all being cast.
And that's astonishing, I guess. I don't know why. Maybe I'm naive, but what type of society do we live in today where we basically say we don't care what the people say, right?
They don't even want to know what the people say.
So what would you call that? I mean, it's not a democracy. It's not a democratic republic. What is that?
I have no idea. And this is one of the things that I have a problem with when it comes to the each particular party, because they get to decide, you know, how their primary system works. And they've got all kinds of just crazy things going on, you know, and they don't want to hear what their constituents, what their people have to say. They just want to pick whoever they want to pick, obviously. And yeah. I love how Ted Cruz is going around bragging about all of the delegates he won here in Colorado when not a single vote's been cast.
It was really a no contest. It was the decision had been made.
Yeah, so. Right. So, I mean, how do you think this whole thing's going to end up?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, you look at the whole, the Republican establishment's essentially saying that, you know, if the votes go to Trump, they're not going to support him. You're looking at contested convention or some.
Oh, that's if he doesn't get to the required 1,237.
If he doesn't get to the required, which I don't know that he's going to. And, you know, Trump is really trying to push, you know, that it should be a kind of the winner take all, or whoever has the highest vote should be the winner. And they're saying, no, you know, that's not the way it works. You have to get the full votes. But who knows what's going to happen? I mean, I don't know if we've ever seen anything like, you know, where our own party would turn against the front runner and say, we're not backing this guy. We're going to, and frankly, they could put someone else, not even Cruz, you know, they could slide someone else in there.
Hey, I have no idea what's going to happen. I think you're pretty correct in your assumption that we've never seen anything quite like this before. So here's something that I've been thinking about. If Trump were to win the nomination, everybody says he's got no chance at all of winning the presidency. And against Hillary, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think he's got a chance?
I think a lot of the naysayers have their head in the sand. I think when you look at kind of the tone and just the feel of our country today, people are fed up with politicians, right? They're fed up with the lifelong politicians, the career politicians. So we have really, you know, we have Donald Trump. Let's just say, for the sake of this conversation, we'll say he is the nominee and Ted Cruz is out. And let's say Hillary is. I can't imagine. I guess I can, but what's Hillary's record? She's done absolutely nothing. Nothing good, nothing noteworthy in her political career. You have scandal after scandal, you know, email servers, security issues. I don't know, Cliff, if Hillary gets elected.
Oh, Lord. What are you going to do then?
Well, I don't know. What, I'm not going to be like the guys. I'm packing up. I'm moving out of the country, you know. By the way, when is Kanye leaving? When is Kanye West leaving?
You know, they say the same thing about if Trump wins, that a lot of people say they're going to leave the country.
Nope. Yeah, well, you know, I'll help them pack.
Do you believe any of that garbage?
No, of course not. I mean, it's just, you know, people throwing a fit. But yeah, I mean...
I understand you don't believe them, but up in Canada, because that's what a lot of people say. They go, if Trump wins or if, you know, XYZ candidate wins, I'm going to move to Canada. So yeah. Rob Calabrese, who's a Nova Scotia radio DJ, decided he's been talking about this on his show. He's like, come on up here. We got a place for you. And he set up a website called Cape Breton, if Donald Trump wins, to kind of promote his little area. It's an island. Okay, and he's like, you know, hey, we're kind of away from the mainland. It's kind of a fun place, and he's got all of the things that make them great, and also some jokes about Trump, of course, because he's not a big Trump fan. He says, we're living on an island where the population is going down, and we thought maybe if we get the word out there that maybe you should come here. He's got some photos of life on the island. They got about 150,000 people living there. And he says, Muslim people can roam freely. The only walls are holding up the roofs of our extremely affordable houses. There's also free health care, and nobody has a handgun. And as of a couple of weeks ago, he had over 35,000 people visiting the website and has been overwhelmed by hundreds and hundreds of people who are literally ready to take him up on the offer. So,
yeah, I mean, it sounds amazing. Unfortunately, I don't think Delta Airlines accepts food stamps. So good luck with those plane tickets, because the people looking to leave the country are the ones who, you know, are undereducated or unwilling to work. And they're waiting for a handout from Uncle Sam. So they're going to be in bad shape when they try to figure out how they're going to get there. And then, what are they going to do once they get there?
Well, right. It is Canada, which is borderline socialist, and they're ready to take care of
you. That's true, but is Canada just openly accepting floods of people?
I think it depends on the situation and the person.
My dad was married briefly.
not if you ask him. I think it was far too long.
Yeah, to a Canadian woman, and it was going to be much harder for him to be a Canadian resident than it was going to be for her to come here.
Oh, right, because they want to limit the number of handouts that they can give you.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, have you ever been in a popularity contest where you had to get support of the people around you, like an election? Have you ever been in a situation where have you just always been the boss? And if you don't like me, here's the door.
No. I think being a boss, largely is, you know, not necessarily a popularity contest, but it's, rallying troops, making your case, gathering buy-in, getting people on board. I mean, you can't, successful leaders in my experience can't lead by, you know, drawing the line in the sand and saying, take it or leave it. I mean, you can, but it's not effective for long. You have to
get some support behind you.
You have to get some support. Yeah. You have to, your people have to be bought in, to make it successful.
Have you ever garnered support from somebody you would really rather not have their support? Like for example, like let's say you're running for Congress and the KKK comes out and says, yes, we support Sean.
No, I've only been in Georgia for a few months, so my path hasn't crossed the KKK yet, Cliff.
So they're not supporting you yet.
Not currently, but no, I see where you're going with that, though. I don't know that I have personally someone, you know, giving me their endorsement, and I'm like, ooh, you know, stay away from that guy. But
Well, we have a case of this for Hillary Clinton. The Nevada sex workers are all coming out, calling themselves hookers for Hillary.
Oh,
yeah,
that's awesome.
And they're trying to arouse some. I like this. The story here says they're trying to arouse interest for Hillary Clinton.
Nice. Hookers for Hillary. I wonder if they're going to team up with the whole $15 an hour, you know, fast food workers.
I'm sure they're for her, too.
Yeah, we should try to set those two groups up. It might be interesting, you know.
Well, there's 490 legal brothels in Nevada that have banded together, including famously the Moonlight Bunny Ranch and the Kit Kat Guest Ranch over near Carson City, the Love Ranch in Las Vegas, and the Alien Cat House, and I would just love to see this place because it's a space themed brothel, so you can pretend like you're hooking up with space aliens near Area 51. And they're backing Hillary because they think that she's the presidential candidate most likely to protect Obamacare from being repealed. And look, that part I understand, because if you're a sex worker, I mean, free health care. Yeah.
Hey, you know.
But I think that there's a little more to a candidate than just health care. I hate these one issue voters.
Well, I think the problem is it's not even just health care. It's, you know, I long for the days of JFK.
I never thought I would say that.
Yeah, but really, I mean, think of where the country's gone today. You know, it used to be, what can I do for my country? And now it's literally like, I'm going to vote for the candidate who's going to give me the most free stuff. And that's scary. It's people fundamentally do not grasp finances and what it takes, you know, probably not even to probably balance their own personal checkbook, let alone to run the largest economy in the world. And I can't remember who this gal was. I was watching a video of the other day, but she was pushing the whole free college thing, right? Free college, free college, free college. And it's like, it's not free. Somebody's paying for that. Somebody's paying for that college.
When Obama was just being elected, one of the phrases I heard is, if you think healthcare is expensive now, just wait until it's free.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's amazing.
I think that applies to college.
No, of course. Yeah, of course it does. And that's the thing, too. So imagine when it becomes an entitlement and everybody gets to go and you think prices are high now. I mean, these colleges are just going to jack up, you know, if they're billing the government, what do they care? You know?
Yeah, they're just going to keep going up higher. And it's.
But I mean, I think it comes from a larger systemic issue, which is the American dream, right? The American dream is dead. At least the American dream in the form of what it used to be, which was I can come from any nation, any background. I can, if I work really, really hard and if I save my money and pay my taxes, I could build a business. I could be somebody. I could come from nothing. I could make something out of myself. I can be a homeowner. I can raise a family. And today the American dream is I can sneak across the border. The day I land in America, I can sign up for food stamps. I can, you know, get government housing. I can get, you know, WIC. I don't know if you know what WIC is. It's for women and children. You know, it's supplemental on top of food stamps. I can't grasp why on earth we would be trying to attract people who literally become ward of the state from day one.
And they like that. This is what they're going for. You know, and right. And in the next segment, I have something about that we'll be talking about. But yeah, people who just it seems like there's more and more people who have their hands out who are like, what are you going to do for me? What are you going to give me? You know, and they're doing things like this because, I mean, it's kind of a silly, jokey story. But I mean, they're really trying to, you know, drum up support by, you know, getting people to go out there and support Hillary because she'll give you more free stuff, you know? And I keep thinking, and I'm not against help. People who are in a hard time and they need a little bit of help to get back on their feet, that's not what I'm against. I'm against living that lifestyle, living on these kinds of entitlement benefits. Because, and I like how they call them benefits, like you're working for them, but yeah, they're not.
I mean, that's kind of two sides of the same coin, but that's a different issue all in itself, right? So on one hand, we're talking about American citizens who are abusing the system, which is bad enough. But on the other, we're talking about non-citizens who are, I guess you could say, also abusing the system, but they're not even citizens. Like we have our own citizens that we can't even take care of and support. And just with open arms, we're welcoming, you know, thousands and thousands of people that literally will just become a larger burden to the country. And it's sad to say, and, you know, from a humanitarian perspective, we talked about this last time we talked. I get it. I get the humanitarian piece, but there's also a financial piece, which is if you don't have the money, you simply don't have the money. Right. Yeah. I mean,
well, we'll just raise taxes on the rich folks.
Right.
You know how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, instead of reining in spending, we're just going to, you know, raise taxes. And at some point though, you seem to be keen on analogies today. So what happens, Cliff, if someone continues to raise your taxes, right? So you, let's say you were one of these immigrants, but you came here the right way and you opened up a store and you saved money for years and years and years. And you got to the point where you opened up two or three stores, right? Not huge, but maybe your business is at least on paper, you know, making $1 million a year. And you don't have a type C corporation, right? Maybe you're a limited liability corporation, or maybe you're just a sole proprietorship. And so the government says, oh, you know, we're only going after millionaires and billionaires, Cliff. And guess what, buddy? You're a millionaire. And now we're going to take, you know, more money from your taxes. And really what it does to you is you have a decision to make is, should I continue to provide jobs, right, and open up that fourth store that I wanted to? I really wanted to open up a fourth store because I could provide 15 more jobs. But if I do, that's really going to put me into the millionaires club. And the government's going to take such a large chunk of that, that it's not even worth my time to do that, right? So at what point do you tax these businesses to the point where they don't want to take risks anymore? They don't want to borrow money. They don't want to hire people because you never know when the government's going to come take more and more of, you know, the fair share.
Well, the next step is going to be to compel these people to provide jobs.
Right, right. Which, by the way, have you yet to hear any politician explain what exactly one's fair share is? Is there a mathematical formula? Has anybody ever said, you know, if you make X dollars, this is what your fair share could be? Because last time I checked, the people in the 1% are taxed at something like a 40 to 50% tax rate.
Yeah, there is a formula that I heard once. It goes something like to each according to his needs, from each according to his ability. I believe that is the formula. You don't need that big house. You don't need all of that extra money.
I see. The other thing that I always find interesting is the ones lecturing us on need tend to be the ones who, you know, are these A-list celebrities with $45 million mansions who fly private jets and, you know, they run around lecturing us on our carbon footprint. You know, John Travolta's flying a 747 cross country and then turns around and lectures us on our carbon footprint. It's,
yeah, that's what you call hypocrite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it always comes from the same type of people because they feel like they're going to change the world somehow. Well, I don't know. I think they ought to change themselves before they worry about me, because I've got a family to feed and they don't. So
I guess Cliff, on the my biggest pet peeve too is, you know, I make good money. I make decent money. I'm probably the lower levels of upper middle class. I've stuck with the same line of work for 16 years.
What? You know, you mean you actually worked on your career?
I did. Yeah, I've been in the same industry for 16 years. I started as a rep, as an agent on the phone, doing that dreaded telemarketing that everybody who complains about not being able to get a job, and you say, hey, you know, the local call center is hiring, they're paying $10 an hour, and they go, oh no, I could never do that. I couldn't work on a computer all day, or I couldn't do that telemarketing stuff. And I explained to them that, wow, there's really a lot of money to be made. It's a huge industry. There's over 30,000 call centers in the US and Canada alone. You know, if you just start on the phone, if you show up, if you have a good attitude and you're nice to customers, you'll promote relatively quickly, because believe it or not, a lot of people can't show up to work on time and refuse to be nice to customers. And it baffles me, Cliff, the same people, you know, won't do it, refuse to do it.
They don't want to turn down a good job. They don't want to work.
But back to my point, though, I mean, I started on the phone making actually $6.15 an hour. But that was back when the minimum wage, I think, was $5.75. So my friends all thought that I was a baller because I was making $6.15 an hour. And in fact, I think you were there at the time, right?
I recall, yes.
At Stream International. Mm-hmm. You know, we were on the phone as well. And long story short, fast forward 16 years, same industry. You know, I've been very fortunate to have been able to gain a ton of experience in business and, you know, got off the phone and, you know, like I said, make good money. I'm able to provide for my family today, but that was through a lot of hard work. It was through a lot of risk. It was through, you know, trying out for promotions and sometimes not getting the job and failing and being heartbroken and having to go back. And
so when you failed, when you didn't get the job you wanted, you immediately quit and went on government assistance, correct?
No, of course not.
And I never tried again.
I took it as a personal challenge. You know, I talked to my managers and I looked at the people around me who are successful and said, what do I need to do? You know, how do I get in your job? What are the things I need to know in order to move to the next level? And I listened and I paid attention. And through adversity, I tried to have a good attitude and keep coming to work every day. And, you know, I tell you, Cliff, I applied for the same job 3 times with the company. And the first time my interview feedback was, that I came across as just completely arrogant, right? So the next time I interviewed for the same job, it was just a promotion, one level up. The feedback was, I was borderline incompetent. I tried to really tone it down, you know? So what do you do with that feedback? First, they tell me you're arrogant, then I'm borderline incompetent. And then finally, I interviewed with another company who literally offered to double my salary. And the senior manager, the director person, tried to talk me out of taking that job. Sean, you're so close to getting this promotion, buddy. You're so close. And I took a huge risk, Cliff. I moved my family from Arizona to Chicago, right? My wife and my 3-month-old daughter. And we moved to Chicago. And that really helped kind of project my career, was taking that huge risk, you know, moving cross country to a brand new job, a brand new company. And we've made a couple moves since then, but it's, you know, you have to be mobile. You have to be willing to sacrifice. And even you look at unemployment, right? You have people who collected unemployment for, I think at one point they raised it to like 2 years, but they were unwilling to leave. They wouldn't leave their market. It's like, if you live in Detroit and you're an auto worker and the factory closes, the answer is not sit in Detroit and wait for them to open a new factory. The answer is go somewhere else.
Go where the money is. Go where the jobs are.
Right. You have to. And so for for the people who look at me and say, oh, you know, he's whatever. I'm not in the top 1%. I'm in the top 5% of earners, which I don't feel like that way because, you know, I got a lot. I pay all my own bills and my own electricity and healthcare and stuff. And, you know, we're not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. But people look at us and assume that, like, you know, I just got lucky and I'm one of those people that they want to tax more and more. And it's like, why should I pay more taxes for you, who you're literally throwing a temper tantrum and saying, I'm going to work at McDonald's and I want you to double my pay.
And they think that nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. Why not? Because I want you to double my pay. Just double it. Like, did I gain any more skills? Am I more talented? Can I drive any more revenue for the company? No, I just want more money. So give it to me. So that whole mindset to me is it's just crazy. And it's borderline offensive to people like us who've struggled and worked hard. I mean, I came from nothing too. You know, single trailer, my mom cleaned houses for a living. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. It's just, it's a pet peeve of mine when I see people refuse to work and then complain about, you know, how messed up the system is and somebody should give them free education.
Well, in the next segment, we're actually going to continue on this theme, and we're going to be talking a little bit about Indian tribes and some of the Native Americans around in this country and some of the things that that I've seen online in the last few days and some of my thoughts on that. So we'll be right back here on the English Express Radio Podcast.
Welcome back to the English Express Radio Podcast, what radio wants to be when it grows up.
All aboard
the English Express.
If you want to be an adoptive parent, it doesn't matter if you're a little different.
I'm a book troll.
Oh, really?
What do you look like?
Your ears aren't pointy.
I slapped on them funny.
Or what you sound like. You just need to be there. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care don't need perfection. They just need you. Call 888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
All right. I know this isn't any fun to talk about, but we should. So, who's going to do what? Flashlights?
Nowhere to be found.
Where to be found? Batteries?
Dead.
Great. Emergency supply kits?
Not packed. No.
What about blankets?
We have an old towel.
Good enough. Cell phones?
May not work.
Emergency water?
Not a drop.
And what about food?
Nope.
Perfect. We all know where we're meeting if we're separated, yeah?
The library.
Aunt Joan's house.
The bus stop.
Great. And I'll be waiting here wondering where you all are. Sounds like we don't have a plan. Who's up for mini golf?
Winging It is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency, who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The last thing my grandfather said to me before he kicked the bucket. He said,
"Hey, how far do you think I can kick this bucket?"
You're listening to the English Express Radio Podcast.
All right, welcome back to the show. Now, Sean, tell me, have you ever lost your wallet or found a wallet?
Yeah, I've definitely lost my wallet. I've never found a wallet. But I think I've lost the wallet a couple times.
Did you ever get it back?
Both times I lost it, I think one time I lost it and never got it back. And the other time, I probably lost the wallet three times. The other times I usually find it about a day after I cancel all my credit card and go down and get another driver's license. And that's, you know, then I'm like, oh, you know, God, I remembered it was in the, you know, the bottom drawer of my dresser. I put it there for safekeeping and I knew surely I would remember it, but never found one though.
Now, this is a little bit of an honesty test then. If you did find a wallet and it's got, let's say it's got about $275 in it and credit cards, license, and everything like that, you know, just a typical wallet of a guy who's, you know, got a lot of stuff in it. Would you keep it? Give it back? What would you do?
You know, I'd want to say I would give it back, but to be completely honest, it would depend on the stage I'm at in my life. You know, if I was out of work and my wife and kids were hungry and I didn't know how I was going to put food on the table, I'd probably...
What if you're a young kid? Remember us back when we were, early 20s, living in the trailer...
Oh no, we definitely would have bought beer and then probably chucked the wallet in a trash can. We were pretty irresponsible at that time.
I actually, when I was younger, God, I must have been 18 or 19 years old, and I was driving this old Honda Prelude. And, you know, you go out to these pick-and-pull places where you can, like, get parts. And while I was pulling a part for this car, I actually found a wallet that had several hundred dollars in it. And I had my good friend, you know, Steve, our good friend yep. Steve, was there. And we actually had a fight about what we should do, whether we should turn it in or not.
So let me guess. Wait, hang on. Let me guess. You, I can hear you trying to convince Steve. I could hear you. Come on, Steve. The guy will never know. I bet he forgot about the wallet anyway. And plus, his car is junked. I bet you he got a big insurance check for the car. He's not even going to miss this money. Is that kind of how that conversation went?
Yeah, but it was the opposite way. I was the one who wanted to give it back. And Steve was like, let's keep it. And and we actually had a big, big fight about it. And I called my mom and I told her that we have this wallet so that, you know, it was kind of like, well, now people know about it. We have to take it back. And my mom drove me down. This was the dude's rent money. He was there trying to pull, you know, vehicle parts just like I was. And he had left it on the seat there. And he really needed that money. And he actually gave me $20 and I didn't want to split it with Steve because I'm like, you didn't want to even give it back.
That's funny.
Yeah. But it was a tough time, especially for a young kid, because like, I'm not going to say I didn't want to keep it, but I felt like I couldn't keep it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, the only time I would consider even remotely doing that, things would have to be dire circumstances for me, but
and it wasn't. I was living at home. I had a job.
Yeah.
I just wanted more money.
Yeah, but I mean, in that situation, so I would probably do the right thing in that situation. But I mean, I know some people. You know, times are tough. You hear about people shoplifting and stuff, shoplifting food, you know, for their kids. So, I heard about a story, I can't remember where it was, but the cop came and instead of arresting the guy, ended up buying, you know, groceries for his family and just gave him a warning.
Yeah. I think I read a story about that last week.
Yeah, desperate times, you know.
Yeah. Well, Riley Flaherty, he lost his wallet at a concert in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, he knew that somebody had picked it up and he didn't really expect to see it again. But a miracle happened. 2 weeks later, an envelope showed up at his house. He found his driver's license, his credit cards, and a note. Did not see his money. He had several hundred dollars in there. It read, I found your wallet and your driver's license, had your address. So here's your credit cards and other important stuff. I kept the cash because I needed some weed. And your bus pass because, well, the fare is $2.75 now. And I kept your wallet because it's kind of cool. From Anonymous.
Well, at least he's honest. You got to give him that.
So kept the wallet, kept the cash, kept his bus pass. And Flaherty says he's never been so conflicted about a nice gesture. So, but the venue where he lost his wallet, they offered him some free tickets and told him to leave his wallet at home this time.
Hey, man, people need their weed. So I tell you what, and the bus pass, that's critical.
Hey, $2.75 each way.
Yeah. And
it's like one of those monthly passes, you know, you can ride as much as you want.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So my first trip here to Atlanta when I interviewed for my new job that I just took a few months ago, usually I'm used to getting a rental car, right? When I interview, when people fly me out to interview and they told me just to take the train down. So for those of you who have never been to Atlanta, which I had never been, it's called the MARTA. And I won't try to tell you what that means, cause I don't remember something Metro something. You could Google it. But I rode the train from the airport, you know, up to Northern Atlanta for the first time ever myself being on a subway like train like that. But I tell you, Cliff, it was kind of a scary experience. You know, there were old drunk men on the train at noon. People, construction workers getting loud and fighting with each other. And I was just clutched to my backpack, my laptop, had a pen in my pocket. And I was like, man, I'm not going to let anybody take my backpack. You know, I had my suit with me. It was kind of nerve-wracking.
I can imagine.
being on the train. Oh, anyway, the point is $3. So in that case, though, it was $3 one way. But I'm told if you don't ride this train, it's literally like a 3-hour drive from southern Atlanta up to where I am here. And I mean, it's like a 30-mile drive, but with traffic, it's like 3 hours.
Wow.
So it takes like 40 minutes. So it was definitely worth the $3. But I got to admit, I was kind of terrified to be on that train. I've never taken my kids on it.
I don't blame you. Yeah. And if you lost something, you'll never get it back.
Oh, absolutely not. That would have been, you know, booze money.
Well, we got another, I got a short break. We went kind of long on the last segment, but we'll be right back after this, this really short break here on the Inks Express Radio Podcast.
Now back to some more wholesome, good-natured family entertainment. Oops, wrong show. You're listening to the English Express Radio Podcast.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
It's times like this, I wish I had listened to what my mother always told me.
What did she say?
I don't know. I wasn't listening.
You're listening to the English Express Radio Podcast.
Welcome back to the show. So, yesterday afternoon, you know I'm a member of an Indian tribe, right, Sean?
I do, yes.
Sorry, yeah, and I've to the mic. Yep.
There you go. Yep. You were leaning back a little bit there. Well, and I've been a member for quite a long time. It's called the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, and they've got a Facebook page where people kind of, talk and discuss about issues that are important to them, and ask each other questions. And yesterday afternoon, somebody just asked a simple question. You know, hey, of the people who are members of the tribe, who lives on the reservation, and who lives off the reservation? Now, I've never even visited the reservation. You know, I live in Colorado now, but I grew up in California. I lived out in New Mexico, which that was an experience.
That was basically like being on the reservation, I hear.
according to what I've heard, and, I lived out in Russia for a couple of years and stuff like that. One of these days, I really would like to visit our reservation. I mean, it is supposedly, you know, where I come from and everything. So, but what I really thought was interesting were some of the comments that people posted up about their particular living situations. You know, oh, I live on the reservation, I live off. And one person said, I live off the reservation. I can't bring myself to rent a place from a non-tribal member on the reservation. Now, our Puyallup Tribal Reservation is one of the most urban reservations in this country. We got a lot of people living there, and they're not all members. A lot of just regular people. Some people, I don't even know if they are aware they're living on a reservation. Somebody else said, I live off the reservation. In Tacoma, there's not enough tribal housing, and it's hard to get into any housing. They make you wait for years. Okay. And that kind of stopped me because I'm like, what, we have tribal housing? Is it like free housing or what? I was a little bit confused. Then somebody says, not only that, but our reservation is occupied by non-natives and non-tribal members. We have to rent the houses from them if they choose to rent their homes. So I'm not sure how it goes. How can you own a home but not the land? So I'm sure that some of them own the land in some way. Does anybody know? He says it's crazy that other reservations have tons of homes on it, but that's okay. I'm satisfied where I'm living. And the other person says, you're right. If these smaller reservations can have tribal housing, why can't we? And I kind of stopped and read that. And surprisingly enough, it made me think of the Mormon Church. Because they own a lot of land. When they came to Utah and Salt Lake City, the church itself owns just a ton of land, especially right in the downtown area. Okay. But what they don't own is a lot of the large buildings and businesses that sit on that land. And they use it to kind of fund a lot of their operations. And the way the church makes money is through leasing the use of that land, and they don't give up their ownership of it. And it kind of seems to me that if you have a tribe on a reservation, they must have like a similar financial agreement with people. So people might lease the land that the home sits on. And whether that's a source of income or not, I don't know. Obviously, putting a multi-million dollar mall or high-rise office buildings is going to bring a lot more revenue than a single-family home. But I don't know. If you were a member of a reservation, would you have a problem with non-Indians living there with you?
That is such a loaded question on multiple levels.
Right? I mean, but this is the things that come up when I'm reading. I'm like, these are the questions I'm asking myself.
You know, I mean, I would think if it was, you know, if money was being generated from it and given back to the tribe, I think it would make sense. But.
And I don't get their problem. Okay. Because like, and I go back to the Mormon church on this one. Okay. So if you have the LDS church who owns land and they lease it to somebody who's, let's say they're pagans. All right. They're not religious in any way. They're atheist or whatever. And they lease this land off from the church. Now, if then you have a church member, are they going to be like, well, I'm not going to rent an office from somebody who's, you know, not a member of the church? Why do they care? You know, I mean, if you have a home or you need an office, you need a place to do things. Who cares who owns the building or who owns the land? You need something, I mean, get it, rent it.
Like I said, I mean, you know, obviously not being of Native American background myself, I don't know. I would say if I had to speculate, maybe it's the whole bad taste left in their mouth of like, hey, we're stealing your land. Hey, we're giving your land back to you. By the way, we're now going to charge you for someone who stole your land, gave it back, and now has a house on your land, and we're going to make you pay rent to rent a house on your own land. Like, I don't know if there's some feeling like that. Like, it's just
maybe they don't understand like what's going on there, because I mean, it's not like the people own the land.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think they don't understand, but I think. You know, when decisions are made, or when you form opinions largely based on emotions and not fact, I mean, God only knows the reasoning behind why they feel that way. But I'm pretty sure if I had to bet, it has a little bit something to do with the whole, the white man took my land
and they don't want to rent a house from a non-member on their own reservation.
And I kind of see where they're coming from there. If that's the reason, like I said, I can only speculate. But
how they feel, I get it. I mean,
barring that though, if it's driving revenue for the tribe, if it's, you know, the land is not actually owned by the person who's putting the house there, if the rent is reasonable, they're not jacking up the rent, you know, a couple hundred percent over, you know, if they don't have like, they haven't cornered the market on rentals and that's your only option. I mean,
yeah, that would be wrong. Or if they're doing any kind of discrimination, like, well, Indians, you know, rent is 25% higher than non-Indians.
Yeah, but I mean, it sounds to me almost like the issue, the one of the concern is more of like other tribes seem to have more housing, and I don't know if that was insinuated to be free housing or extremely affordable,
you know,
or cheap.
Yeah, and that's actually my bigger issue. Okay, when the person mentions that there's not enough tribal homes, and I'm like, are these homes like free to live in? And they kind of mentioned a little bit later on in that conversation that these tribal homes, the ones that are available, have to conform to housing and urban development, HUD, HUD regulations. Okay, so it seems to me like it's the free housing on par with like Section 8. Now, do you know much about Section 8 housing?
I don't know much about Section 8, but I know a little bit about the HUD regulations because we've bought and sold a few homes. And, the first time we bought a house, we were eligible under a first time home buyer type program. And essentially because we got an FHA loan as opposed to a conventional loan, FHA made the terms of the FHA loan were that any house that we moved in had to be compliant with HUD regulations. And so HUD has regulations around a lot of safety things, lead paint, asbestos, you know, there's just a whole slew of things. You know, you have to have modern, you know, copper, PVC plumbing. Basically, it's got to be inspected and safe to live in for women, children, and families. It's just,
I don't have any problem with that.
Yeah, ultimately, they want to make sure that you're moving into a safe place. That's kind of the HUD piece of it. So, but typically, yeah, when you're looking at HUD compliant, it usually ties in with subsidized housing, which could be Section 8 or some other form thereof, you know, subsidized housing.
Okay. Well, you know, and subsidies aren't something that I particularly have a problem with. I think I mentioned this in the first segment that I've never had a problem with helping people out. There are a lot of people in this world that are less fortunate than us. They've gone through a lot more troubles than either you or I have. And that's not to mean that, I mean, we weren't born with silver spoons in our mouths. We've had our struggles, but I'm not going to say that there aren't people out there who've had it worse than we have.
No. Yeah. And I agree wholeheartedly. I think there is a need for those types of things. And I have no issue with it. I am a strong fan of the work for welfare type programs where, if you're able-bodied and you can work, I think you should do something, right? You should, if you're having a hard time getting a job, I think, you know, one of the biggest, obstacles I'm told is, you know, single mothers and childcare, because the price of childcare is just astronomical. So,
oh yeah. Oh, I got a story about that later. Maybe yeah, for
why
another
not,
show.
Why don't you get, you know, 10 single mothers together and open a government run daycare center, and at least your labor's covered and they can help watch the kids. I mean,
if they can afford it. I mean, I understand it's hard for people. It's tough for people, and people get stuck in these cycles, particularly with Native Americans in this country. You know,
that's what I'm saying, though. I mean, when you look at the work for welfare, you could take, you know, 10 people who are collecting assistance, put them in daycare centers to provide free daycare for other people so they can now be freed up to work. So I think able-bodied people should work. I don't think welfare should be a lifestyle or your long-term, you know, path to sustainability.
No, but a little bit of help can help people out, kind of like rise up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what it's for.
And I've always been a big fan of self-reliance, but people kind of seem to take that the wrong way. Like, oh, I need to be self-reliant and only do it all by myself. But, I mean, a lot of times we do need help. I think about, like, way back in the old days, you know, you grow up in an Indian tribe, you know, the old way, right? And they hunt, and they kind of, you grow up into a man, and you get married. Pretty soon it's time to set up your own teepee. I'm betting people were there to help you build it, you know? And I kind of think of the Amish are the same way. They're some of the most self-reliant, hardworking people I know. But when they're going to raise a barn, you know, old Ezekiel and Jonathan come out and they all make it a big weekend and they help each other out. You know, that doesn't mean that that's not welfare, because you're right there beside them kind of working as well. And in the modern age, I think some common sense limits on the length of time in truly subsidized housing or free housing, you know, you can live there for a period of time, but then there's a time limit on it, you know, and they need to get out there and kind of make their own way. When I first moved to Utah, did you ever visit my aunt and uncle's place?
Yeah, I did. It was a beautiful, beautiful place. That basement was amazing.
Yeah, I loved that place. And they gave me that place for, I think it was $100, $150 a month. I mean, just this ridiculously low rent. And I was kind of like, I had time to get up on my feet. But they told me from the beginning, hey, it's a time-sensitive thing. This is not a forever deal. And when it came time for me to move out, and they said, hey, Cliff, you know, maybe it's about time. I mean, I could have been a jerk and set and claim residency, make them go through all of the legal eviction processes if I was a jerk. I was out of there within a week, you know, because I had been because of their helpfulness, because of their assistance to me, I was able to save some money, get ready to get into my own place like overnight, You know, they were surprised at how fast I moved out. And I kind of feel that that ought to be the way that subsidized or free housing situations should be. But anymore, it kind of seems like people are have this like different type of mentality. Like they feel like we need to build more houses for people to live in for free, you know? I don't know.
Yeah.
If I ever found myself in that situation, I'd take the help. I'm not trying to say you shouldn't take the help. I'm just saying you should also like consider it a challenge to like, now I want to get out there on my own, you know, but people don't think that way anymore.
No. And I think though, it stems from a larger issue, which is just the way we were raising our children anymore, because the analogy you provided earlier, which was, you know, the young, let's say a young male, you know, he learns to hunt, he learns to fish, he learns to, you know, make clothing and build that teepee. And he's given all the tools and resources and knowledge on how to do it. So when it's time to be self-reliant, he's rock and roll and ready to go. Right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if he wasn't self-reliant after being given all the tools and the knowledge and the training, I'm sure that wouldn't go over too well if he said, you know what, you know, Dad, I think I'm just going to chill in your teepee for a couple more years and figure out this whole adult thing. Right. I mean, that would never fly back then. And I think it's a sign of the times. It's culturally, you know, we moved from where there was a sense of pride and work ethic and you really wanted to work hard and get out on your own and show the world what you had. We've gone away from that, and it's literally, okay, world, when are you going to come develop me? When are you going to give me more stuff? And I see it every day in business with the young kids. You know, I say kids, God, we're getting old, Cliff, but you know, these 18 to 25 year olds who, you know, want to come in and they want to make 60 grand a year and be managers, you know, because they have a brand new college degree.
Oh, and they think they're entitled to it.
You're entitled to it. Yeah. So like, well, okay, when am I going to get the 6-figure salary? And it's like, slow down there, Scooter, you know,
got to pay your dues.
You got a lot to learn, buddy, you know? So, yeah.
And it boggles my mind. The people who would accept help and just continue to accept it. I've got a great example of this. Okay. The richest Native American Indian tribe in the country is the Shakopee Mittawakaton tribe up in Minnesota, okay? They're only 460 members. Yeah, 460 members, and they've got a huge, amazing casino up there. And they receive, let's see here, $84,000 a month. Every single person, 84 grand a month. Now I ask you, Sean, if somebody was giving you, I mean, this is a free lunch in every sense of the word. And if somebody wants to give me $84,000 a month, that's over $1 million a year, I'm not going to say no. Would you accept it?
Of course. Absolutely, I would accept it.
What would you do with it, though?
Would
you just kick back and do nothing? You could with that kind of money.
I'd probably start a business, and I would probably start some sort of charitable organization, and, you know, hopefully give something back. But I would absolutely try to make that into more money, start a business and invest it. And
because what if it doesn't last? I mean, laws can change. They can take the casino away from you. I mean, you better believe I'm going to take that money. But the only thing that's going to change with me isn't whether or not I'm going to work, but where and what it is what I'm doing.
Yeah, you work on your own terms and doing something hopefully that you can make a wage at, but something that you love doing.
Well, this tribe has 99.2% unemployment. 99%, over 99% have no jobs. They don't work. Obviously, they don't need to, but they just sit around in their giant houses, send their kids to public school, and just live off the money. If it were me, I can tell you right now, I'd be buying hotels. I mean, $1 million a year, you better believe I can get financing. And I'm going to be spending $8-9 million on my own hotel and trying to build like kind of my own personal economy, you know, with that kind of money.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things you could do. And honestly, I think the sit around thing, it sounds crazy, but I feel like that would get old after a while, you know?
Oh, I couldn't live.
I'd want to do something meaningful.
Right. I feel like if you were in that situation and you just do nothing, you're going to get into a rut. And I think that that's what's happening to a lot of these people who are on welfare, who are receiving free housing or, you know, being taken care of. They get into, I mean, it's at a much lower level, but they get, I think it kind of creates the same kind of a situation where they don't know how to go out there and get jobs. They don't know how to work. They don't know how to be productive, you know? And I think in both instances, you kind of say, well, what do I have and how can I take my benefits and make them into a more productive situation? You kind of see what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. I absolutely.
Maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of how I feel.
I just thought of something funny, and I'm going to digress for a second. But did you hear about this $300,000? It was either a plate or a couple dinner George Clooney hosted for the
No, campaign. I didn't hear about this.
Yeah, so $300,000 per. It was either per couple or per plate, and they interviewed George Clooney, and they said, "Isn't that ridiculous to charge that much?" And he said, "No, absolutely. It's absolutely crazy to charge that much money." But, you know, the party needs it. We need that money. We got to raise that money for Hillary, essentially. It's once again the hypocrisy, right? We mm-hmm. can throw millions and millions of dollars at Hillary's campaign. But couldn't you do a fundraiser and turn that money back over to the poor people that are voting for Hillary?
Something. Or kind of use it to benefit them, at least, you know? And I don't understand the people on these reservations. You know, if you have money as well, why do you have to do it on the reservation? There's nothing that prevents you from buying land elsewhere.
You know? Yeah, I don't know. And I guess it ties back to, you know, maybe they're afraid to take a risk, move away. I don't know. I'd be out the door, man. I'd be gone. You would have to tell me twice.
Right? Well, I don't know. Anyway, I got about 2 or 3 minutes left. So, do you have any final words?
No, I got nothing, man.
I've got one more thing to talk about. Okay? Right. Have you ever had people who just don't show up to work, or I mean, they call in and they say they're sick or whatever? Oh, I'm sure you've done that. Have you ever called in sick when you weren't really sick?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you think the main reasons are? Like, why did you stay home when you did?
A lot. I've been hungover. I just plain didn't want to go to work. I wanted to go fishing. I had more important stuff to do. New video game release. I mean, I could go on all day.
According to a survey, a third of the people who call into work when they're not really sick, they just didn't feel like going in. Another third said they just wanted a relaxation day. 20% had doctor's appointments. Another 20% wanted to sleep in. And 11% said bad weather.
Wow. You know, I'll tell you, being a people manager, I don't care. You don't want to come in. I don't care the reason. Don't come in. Like, you have paid time off. If my people work hard, hey, boss, I'm not feeling it today. don't give me an excuse. Just tell me you're not feeling it.
You'll love some of the excuses people gave. CareerBuilder.com compiled they asked hiring managers and, you know, workforce managers just like yourself. And some of the excuses that people give, they can't just say, I'm sick, I'm not feeling it. One person said, there's a casserole in the oven, and I just can't leave it. It'll burn. Another one, my plastic surgery needs a little tweaking to get it just right. My feet and legs fell asleep while I was sitting in the bathroom, and when I stood up, I broke my ankle.
That's headed a good to the one. Hospital.
Okay, I like this one. I was gambling at the casino all weekend, and I've still got a little money left. I need to stay and win it back.
Hey.
Hey, that's somebody who's dedicated. Okay. I'm stuck in a blood pressure machine at the grocery store.
That's a good one. Get the Crisco out.
Hey, got a little lucky last night, and I'm not sure where I am this morning.
Oh, I mean, who hasn't called in for that reason?
Okay, I just washed my uniform, but I don't have a dryer, so I put it in the microwave to dry, and now it's caught on fire.
Ooh, that's creative.
Okay, I woke up in a good mood, and I don't want to ruin it. That one's at least more honest, but my favorite is, I accidentally got on a plane.
Wow, how does one accidentally get on a plane? I guess maybe if you're hanging out in Vegas.
Right? Like, you go through security, accidentally got on a plane.
Hey, you know, stranger things have happened. I had one instance of a guy who said he tripped over his dog and hurt his back. That was probably the weirdest one I heard.
Oh, goodness. Anyway, I'm glad you joined us today. I had a good time. We'll be back next week. You'll be able to hear yourself. I'm glad we got to do a whole hour this time.
Hey, all right.
All right, anyway. Well, thanks for joining us today. Listen online, theenglishexpress.com, and we'll see you guys next week.
Welcome back to the English Express Radio Podcast, what radio wants to be when it grows up.
All aboard!
The English Express.